G'day guys, Elliot here. Welcome back to Anthology of Heroes. It has been a while, but I'm glad to say I've finally settled back into Melbourne, Australia. I managed to dig myself out of the mounds of IKEA boxes to get this episode recorded. For any new listeners, in this show we share gritty stories of figures and events that changed world history. And today we're coming up blazing with a story I've been itching to share with you guys for a long time. If you're listening to a history podcast, I've got a pretty good idea that you're into ancient Egypt. I know that because for many kids, myself included, it was the pyramids and their towering, exotic pharaohs that lit the spark of interest in history. You can see why, right? An ancient civilization so different from ours, one so imposing and advanced that seemed to just vanish beneath the sands, waiting to be rediscovered one day. You know one fact that still makes me go wow every time I hear it? Cleopatra, the famous queen of Egypt, is closer to our time, as in 2024, than she is to the date when the Great Pyramids were initially built. I mean, the oldest hieroglyphics we've identified are from around 3000 BC. That's 5,000 years ago. Egypt was the first real nation-state. It lasted for over 3,000 years. That's, what, triple the duration of the Roman state? And so far, still longer than our own Western civilization. Growing up, I remember I had one of those big, thick DKI witness books. You know the ones I mean, right? They're full of pictures of huge, crumbling temples, brilliantly coloured hieroglyphics, and bizarre animal-headed gods. What kid wouldn't be into that? Flicking through the pages, there was the famous gold mask of Tutankhamun, the boy king, the towering monoliths of Ramses II, and the beautiful carved bust of Queen Nefertiti. But there's one figure you won't find in those books, a pharaoh named Akhenaten. In fact, if the ancient Egyptians had their way, we would never know he existed at all. Before this pharaoh's body was even cold, his statues were being smashed to pieces, his religious edicts erased, and the very record of his life scrubbed from the imperial record. As soon as he was gone, it was like everyone just wanted to pretend he was never there. Why? What did this man do to warrant such hatred? Did he deserve it? Over the course of the next two episodes, you'll learn the incredible lost story of Pharaoh Akhenaten. I promise you this is a wild one, full of incest, religious cults, body dysmorphia, lost temples, vanity, and above all, power. It's also an unfinished story. Because of how intensely his memory was damned, there are tons of gaps in Akhenaten's story. Gaps that every special interest group you can think of has slotted in to fill. Akhenaten has been called the first gay man, the first monotheist, the first trans person, a role model for modern families, and the patron saint of pedophiles. He's inspired the works of feminist artist Frida Kahlo and has been a point of fascination for psychoanalyst Sigmund Freud, who speculated that the pharaoh had been a mentor for the biblical figure Moses. Afrocentrists point to him as a missing link to forgotten deeds of black Africans, while Nazis declare him a partial Aryan, a forefather of their racial purity policies. There are people who point to him as the first communist, a man who envisioned a new utopia for his people. But just as many others would describe his vision more akin to that of Kim Jong-il's dystopian North Korea. By the end of this series, whatever you think of him, I think you'll agree with Egyptologist James Henry Breasted, who called him the first individual in history. For a person we know only by fragments of statues and chips of smashed tablets, his personality oozes through the dusty passages of time. This is going to be a two-part series. The first episode is going to focus predominantly on the rediscovery of this pharaoh and of his father, Amenhotep III. To know Akhenaten, you've really got to know his dad, because the son's rule was, in many ways, the evolution of his father's vision, just cranked up to 11. For this episode, we're lucky enough to have some primary sources, a collection of clay tablets collectively referred to as the Amarna letters, that record communication between Amenhotep III, Akhenaten, and neighbouring kings. I found these tablets so interesting because some of them are just so petty. They were written thousands of years ago in a language that died out long ago, but the contents of them wouldn't look out of place in a Reddit comment section today. Ego, sex, threats, and squabbling over money. We really never do change, do we? As a warning, this episode makes passing references to incest. So, let's get started. The story of the most hated man ever to rule ancient Egypt. Akhenaten, the heretic pharaoh. Part 1. Like father, like son.
America. We are endowed by our creator with certain unalienable rights. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. At Grand Canyon University, we believe in equal opportunity. And the American dream starts with purpose. To serve others in ways that promote human flourishing and create a ripple effect of transformation for generations to come. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu.
I'm Allison Holland, host of the Kennedy Dynasty Podcast. Equipped with a microphone and a long-term fascination of the Kennedy family, I am joined by an incredible cast of experts, friends, and guests to take you on a fun, relaxed, yet informative journey through history and pop culture. From book references to fashion to philanthropy to our modern expectations of the presidency itself, you'll see that there is so much more to Kennedy than just JFK or conspiracy theories. Join me for the Kennedy Dynasty Podcast.
It's the year 1887. In a mud bank on the east side of the Nile River, a peasant digs at the sandy soil. Behind her, a wooden cart, piled high with slabs of mud brick. Ancient building material that made excellent fertilizer. Little did that woman know that 3,200 years ago, in that very spot, stood an ancient post office in an Egyptian city unlike any other. As the wind whipped up the sands, the woman pulled her headscarf down to shield her eyes, just as her shovel hit something hard and hollow. It wasn't mud brick. Her heart stopped dead as she excitedly dug at the ground, heaving up a wooden box. A box that hadn't been touched by human hands for over 3 millennia. Her mind raced as she dragged the heavy chest from the earth. What lay inside? Gold? Silver? Jewels? But as she ripped the ancient lid from its hinges, her heart sank. Blocks. Old clay blocks, with strange triangles drawn on them. Pulling out the first layer and peering beneath was just as disappointing. Every one of them looked the same. With a heavy heart, she tossed the tablets back into her cart. Many broke, but who cares? Whatever they were, they didn't look valuable, and they certainly weren't gold. Perhaps she'd get a few pennies for them at the market. As she kept digging for the mud brick, the woman had no idea that in the back of her cart lay the key to illuminating the darkest chapter in Egyptian history, a period that modern historians call the Amarna period. By the turn of the 20th century, Egyptology had come a long way. The discovery of the Rosetta Stone had paved the way for the reading of hieroglyphics, while the unearthing of the enormous Abu Simbel temple had lit Europe on fire. The discovery seemed endless. Almost every day, another enormous, immaculate statue was hauled from the grounds of this ancient land. All around Europe, but especially in France and England, rich young men left the comfort of their chateaus and flocked to the mysterious land of Egypt. Never since the Crusade had so many rich Europeans departed into Muslim lands in such great numbers. All wanting to carve their name in the history books, their destination was usually two places. The mouth of the Nile, where, under the shade of the pyramids and the watchful gaze of the Sphinx, they could search for fame in the ruins of Memphis or Giza. Or the southern city of Luxor, where the Middle Temple's kingdom capital of Thebes once stood. But what lay in between? In 1799, when Napoleon's soldiers trampled through Egypt, one of his cartographers was taken by a sprawling ruin on the east bank of the Nile. Located seemingly in the middle of nowhere was a large, well-planned city that he guessed may have housed up to 50,000 people at one point. The nomads squatting in it called it Amarna, after their clan name, but none had any clue as to the history of it. Smack bang in the middle of the traditional northern and southern capitals of ancient Egypt, the city seemed purpose-built. And when the sun's delicate rays reached over the crumbling yellow cliffs, it all but confirmed it. The city was put here for a reason. After sketching what became the very first map of the city, the cartographer and his army moved on, and for almost 100 years, the forgotten city of Akhetaten lay slumbering, its secrets simmering, beneath the sands. It was only when, in 1887, a local peasant woman sold some clay tablets to an antique dealer that interest in the mysterious city was renewed. Sir Flinders Petrie, a silvered British archaeologist and pioneer in Egyptology, was tipped off to the arrival of several strange crumbling tablets through a friend of his at the Cairo Museum. As soon as the aged lord cast his eyes over the tablets, he knew they were unusual. The language on the Amarna letters, as we'll refer to them going forward, was cuneiform, the oldest written language in human history, originating from the modern areas of Iran and Iraq. To find something within the borders of ancient Egypt that weren't written in hieroglyphics was already unusual, but that was just the start of the mystery. Petrie scooped up the tablets and bought them before his academic friends who could read cuneiform. They could make out some words, but told him the dialect was peculiar and varied. Sub-tablets were inscribed in different languages, including a lone letter in Assyrian dialect known as Hurrian. Petrie was shocked to learn that this was the only long-form account of this language ever discovered. Realizing now the importance of what these tablets could contain, Petrie raced through the antique shops of Cairo, frantically trying to buy up every one of the fragile artifacts and translate them before their secrets were lost for good. Once he'd secured as many as he could, he took the next desert caravan to where they were found and soon arrived at Amarna. Before Petrie's arrival, there had been speculative interest in the area. Everyone seemed to know that something had stood there once. But with Petrie's open checkbook, one of the first real excavations began. Busying himself in the ruins, he began sketching what he found, and what he saw surprised and disturbed him. A seasoned Egyptologist, Petrie was used to the usual portraits of Amun-Ra, the falcon god, Wajit, the snake god, or Isis, the divine protector. But these deities were nowhere to be found. Likewise, the portraits of strong, proud, athletic pharaohs were missing. As the sands of Amarna revealed their ancient secrets, the reoccurring find was a portrait of a man. At least, he thought he was a man, though he was no pharaoh Petrie recognized. His skull was long and oval-shaped, like an alien, his lips plump and feminine, and his eyes long, almost almond-shaped slits. In his physique, he seemed almost malnourished. He had a sagging paunch of a stomach, thin arms and calves, and wide, womanly hips. After a few moments, staring into the ancient face of the pharaoh, perhaps Petrie wished to look away, to avert his gaze. The pharaoh's obscene proportions and sinister smile seemed to whisper, "Love me, but fear me." Laborers swore in Arabic as they hoisted the enormous statue from its sandy tomb as Petrie looked the figure up and down. Who was this person with such a warped body? Were these statues accurate representations? And even if they were, why would a pharaoh choose to portray himself in such a way? Accompanying the figure in almost every scene was a small, circular disc, clearly meant to represent the sun. And from it came rays of light with peculiar grasping hands and fingers, many of which clutched an ankh, the symbol of life. Whatever the circular disc was, one thing was clear. The light it gave was reserved only for this figure and his family. The public, who were noticeably portrayed with the usual Egyptian anatomy, were not worthy of receiving the light. Instead, they worshipped the royal family, who in turn worshipped the disc. By the time Petrie returned to Amarna, the news of the stone tablet had made waves. Tourists and rubberneckers flocked to the backwater, eager to see this odd-looking figure. There were no paths set up, so they trudged over local crops, and farmers, hoping to reduce foot traffic, defaced and destroyed many of the ancient reliefs. Petrie's sketches are now the only records of these artifacts that had survived for over three millennia. Speculation ran ripe as to what was wrong with this figure. Did he have some ailment? Some speculated that he suffered from Marfan syndrome, a condition shared by Abraham Lincoln that resulted in slender frames with unusually long, wiry limbs. Others insisted it was clearly a woman who had wished to look like a man for whatever reason. The truth would soon be revealed, and it was much stranger than anyone could have imagined. Later Long before the times of Caesar or even Alexander the Great, it was the kingdom of Egypt that reigned supreme. Like the sands of the desert where its citizens made their home, the kingdom was almost timeless. Empires rose and fell around it, and though occasionally humbled, the kingdom always rose again. By the time of the 18th dynasty of what historians now refer to as the New Kingdom, Egypt as a state was already thousands of years old. The 18th dynasty was one built on foreign conquest, stable government, and cultural splendor. Its founder had come to power after wrestling control back from a foreign dynasty that had come to dominate Egypt over the preceding centuries. In the not-too-distant past, the Kingdom of Egypt had teetered on the brink of total annihilation. Occupied by foreign rulers and losing most of their territory, a succession of great warrior kings and queens had fought an outnumbered war and against all the odds had reclaimed their ancient throne, a dynasty born in blood. This return of the king moment was accompanied by a significant shift in power from the northern capital, Memphis, to a newer southern capital, Thebes. Ancient Egypt was polytheistic, meaning they worshipped many gods, but everyone had a deity they favoured. And for Pharaoh Amenhotep III, that god was Amun, the creator god. Sometimes he's also called Amun-Ra after his merge with Ra, the sun god. The sudden elevation of Thebes as a national capital had been primarily responsible for the sudden explosion in popularity of Amun-Ra. It was taken for granted that Amun's favour had been pivotal in their dynasty's success in reclaiming the throne. And for that, the creator god was owed their eternal loyalty. And there were few as devoted to Amun-Ra as Amenhotep III. Pharaoh Amenhotep III stood as a pinnacle in an already prosperous dynasty. Sometimes called Amenhotep the Magnificent, we only have to count his surviving statues to know this guy was a big deal. The world today has more statues of him than any other pharaoh. The scale of his building projects too had not been seen since the ancient time of the pyramids. Like reeds in the Nile, foreign kings of every color and stature bowed low before Amenhotep the Magnificent. His empire shared the world stage with a couple of big players, Babylon, Assyria, the Mitanni, and the Hittites, to name a few. And though the rulers of this ancient VIP club referred to each other as brother, each of them begrudgingly acknowledged Egypt as the jewel in the crown. In one of the Amarna letters, we see King Tushratta of the Mitanni write from his empire in northern Syria to Amenhotep III, quote, "For me all goes well. For you may all go well. For your household, for your wives, for your sons, for your nobles, for your warriors, for your horses, for your chariots, and in your country may all go very well." We can easily imagine the oh-so-uninterested Amenhotep III motioning his court scribe to hurry it along as the letter was read out to him, waiting for Tushratta to get to the point. The letter continues, quote, "May my brother send me unworked gold in very great quantities, and much more gold than he sent to my father. In my brother's country, gold is as plentiful as dirt." There it was, the tacit acknowledgement that Egypt was richer and therefore mightier. According to the archaeological record, Amenhotep III undeniably possessed a truly staggering amount of gold. On a single temple, a surviving work order shows an order for 3.25 tons of gold, let alone bronze, copper, or any other precious stones. Amenhotep III lived in a world of opulence that was completely alien to the population he ruled. Vast palace complexes adorned with exotic, vibrant textures and walls literally covered in frescoes of him, arm in arm with the gods. The trappings of power pervading every corner of his sprawling palaces. Golden ebony tables that hosted an opulent array of intricately blown glass perfume bottles and silver trays overflowing with dates, figs, and jars of honey. His sexual appetite, too, was voracious. The imperial harem overflowed with women from all over the world, including one lovely lady whose name meant, and I promise I'm not making this up, "She whose nights on the town are numerous." Every one of Amenhotep's senses was indulged. Basking in such opulence, it's easy to understand his bold reaction when anyone dared to compare themselves to him as their equal. Captured in another one of the Amarna letters, he responds to a request for one of his daughters to marry the Babylonian king. You can almost hear Amenhotep's incredulity as he writes, quote, From time immemorial, no daughter of the king of Egypt is given to anyone. A response which clearly didn't go well, as the Babylonian king replied, quote, "When I wrote about marrying your daughter in accordance with your practice of not giving a daughter, you wrote to me saying, 'From time immemorial, no daughter of the king is given to anyone.' Why not? You are a king, you do as you please. Were you to give a daughter, who would say anything?" Women, gold, spices, slaves, all were provided to the great pharaoh. And if he would grace you with so much as a thank you, well, consider yourself blessed. This kind of ego had not sprung up overnight. By the year 1383, Amenhotep had ruled for over 30 years. Amun-Ra had clearly blessed him with an unusually long life. And as he approached his third decade of rule, the king flirted with the idea that he was a cut above pharaohs of the past. To celebrate his upcoming jubilee, he held lavish, expensive festivals that sometimes lasted months. And while the public no doubt loved a day off as much as we do, they must have noticed the spectacles were becoming stranger. Navigating the bustling streets of Thebes, high priests ceremonially paraded statues of Amun, the creator god, and Ra, the falcon-headed god of the sky. And pressed in between them was the image of Amenhotep himself. Sometimes he wore the god's clothing, other times he took on their aspects, their powers. A pharaoh underlining his closeness to the gods was nothing new. The pyramid age was long in the past, and without these colossal structures to remind the subjects of their subservience, pharaohs demonstrated to the subjects their physical and spiritual closeness to the gods as a way of proving their right to rule. But soon statues of the pharaoh progressed past him sitting alongside the gods. Now it seemed the pharaoh wished to be represented as a god. Pharaohs were understood to be the intermediary between the gods and the mortals, but Amenhotep wanted to be seen as one of them. From a young age, the pharaoh seemed to harbour a bit of an obsession with the cosmos, particularly the sun. He favoured the gods or their aspects that were related to the sky or the sun. Amun, the creator of the solar system, Mut, Amun's wife and mother of the world, and their son, Khonsu, god of the moon. And if an average Egyptian citizen stopped to admire one of Amenhotep's colossal statues that adorned their streets, they'd notice, not always but sometimes, a glowing orb stamped on the king's body. The orb was known as the Aten, A-T-E-N. The Aten was nothing new for Egyptians. Ra was usually pictured with the Aten above his head, almost like a halo. There wasn't all that much mythology behind the disc itself, and this allowed the pharaoh to construct his own narrative. It was there where he would return to rule after his sovereignty on earth came to an end. Increasingly, Amenhotep III began to identify personally with the Aten. For a pharaoh that blazed brighter than all others, it only seemed to make sense to select this symbol to symbolize his reign, something that his young son, Akhenaten, would have observed. As Amenhotep III aged, his megalomania grew. For his chief consort, a woman called Ti, he constructed an enormous man-made lake at her hometown. His statues sprung up in every major city from Memphis to Thebes. To Amenhotep, there was nothing he could not achieve, no challenge too difficult, no province too distant for his light to reach, so much so that he soon added a new title for himself, the Dazzling Sun Disk. High priests found their services altered by the pharaoh to include prayers not for, but to the Aten. Around the year 1383 BC, Amenhotep III celebrated his jubilee. 30 years on the throne was a momentous and rare achievement, and one that only seemed to prove his divinity. In Thebes, along the west bank of the Nile, a truly lavish procession took place. This festival had been years in the making, no expense was spared. Like the sun crossing the sky at dawn, Amenhotep and his entourage set off down a stone highway that connected the two enormous temples. Crowds pushed and shoved, jostling for a view. Many who couldn't make the journey to the capital instead paid a friend to bring a small statue in hope that the magic of the ceremony would rub off in the statue and be transferred to the owner. The entire length of the road was girded by stone sphinxes, over 10,000 in total. Priests of Amun walked alongside the pharaoh, throwing out rings, bangles, and necklaces, gifts for the commoners to remember the occasion. Thebes was alive. Rhythmic drum beats pulsed and the aroma of incense wafted over the procession as heavy statues suspended in litters trailed behind. Members of the public thronged forward, jostling for a chance just to touch the stone statues. And the pharaoh's personal bodyguards looked on, their hands on their club for any signs of disobedience. Amenhotep III, draped in rich cottons and silks threaded with gold, led the parade. Ale was passed out freely, and as the crowd got merrier, the young Akhenaten, Amenhotep's son, observed with wide-eyed wonder. The flocking crowds, the sounds, the towering temple columns, the colours, the gold. Who else but a god could arrange such a spectacle? This, he must have seen, was true power, and pivotal to it all was the Aten. Shining bright in the sky, its golden rays stroked the brow of his father. As the road ended, the procession reached an enormous gateway leading to another temple. This time, the crowd was held back. From here, Amenhotep marched on alone. One innocent-looking fresco painted for the occasion even recorded the moment of the pharaoh's divine conception. His mother, Mutemwea, and his father, Thutmose IV, in the imperial bedchamber. But wait a minute, that wasn't Thutmose. It was Amun-Ra dressed up as Thutmose. If picturing the pharaoh's mother copulating with a literal god was too subtle for anyone, we're lucky enough to know that Mutemwea really enjoyed the encounter, as the plaque below tells us, quote, "She awoke because of the god's scent and cried out with pleasure before his majesty. She rejoiced at the sight of his beauty, and the love of him suffused her body. By now, in a state of ecstasy, Mutemwea swooned over the god, exclaiming, 'How great is your power! Your sweet fragrances stiffen all my limbs.'" After the deed was done, Amun-Ra, presumably while he waited for his Uber, told the queen, quote, "Amenhotep, ruler of Thebes, is the name of this child I have placed in your womb. He shall exercise potent kingship in this entire land. He shall rule the two lands like Ra forever." Through the dimly lit palace, Amenhotep walked to the inner sanctum for an entirely new ritual, his personal meeting with his father, Amun-Ra. After a brief delay, having received divine instructions, the pharaoh emerged to his adoring public on an elevated platform, adorned in a dazzling set of new garments. The somber and serious king who had marched into the temple re-emerged, energized, sprightly, and youthful. Though subtle, this change was symbolically profound. New statues were unveiled to the public, and in them, Amenhotep III took on a new appearance. The pharaoh appeared leaner, stronger, almost reborn. Cartoon-like eyes, large lips, and high cheekbones graced his countenance. His face, his whole person, had been rejuvenated from his mystical communion with the god. Amun had quite literally blessed the pharaoh. So close was their bond. Every bit of this ceremony had been pre-planned. Even the material for these new statues were quarried from specifically selected red and gold quartzite, stones that were known to sparkle and dance in the light. The public must have shielded their eyes, nearly blinded by the dazzling, rejuvenated image of their king. In his statue's metaphor and propaganda, the message Amenhotep III wished to convey was that he had surpassed the role of a king or a pharaoh. No longer was he just these people's ruler, he neared the status of their god. The Jubilee Festival, more than any other, would have been where the young Akhenaten would have observed the truly staggering power that one man could wield. Unbeknownst to the drunken crowd, the teen's observations would later usher in one of the darkest moments in their history, under the glowing light of the Aten. Amenhotep III would celebrate a second and even a third Jubilee festival, but none would be as grand as the first. He may not have wanted to acknowledge it, but his kingdom was dipping into a recession. Amenhotep had been an unusually insular ruler. For a dynasty that had muscled their way back into power, he had led exactly zero foreign campaigns. And even to his vassals, he was aloof and distant. No foreign booty combined with this obsession with building. Well, let's just say money was getting a little tight. Egypt was the greatest power in the region, but that didn't mean the pharaoh could sit idle in his ivory tower. But an even more pressing issue was weighing on his mind. For everything that his communion with Amun-Ra had provided him, there was one thing that he was denied. Time. Contrary to the towering youthful athlete shown in his statues, Amenhotep III was arthritic, overweight, and old. Painful abscesses and dry sockets in between his teeth put him in a perpetually cranky mood, and by the time he hit his mid-40s, succession was on his mind. His heir apparent, Thutmose, had died at an early age, and though Amenhotep had many wives, including two of his own daughters, he had only one living son. His name was Amenhotep IV, but to make things easy to follow, we've used and will continue to use the name he's known by today, Akhenaten. As we get into Akhenaten's stories, there are going to be big chunks that are still missing, and as you'd expect from a figure so controversial, there are many different opinions as to what took place in these gaps. For the sake of keeping the story moving, I'm not going to stop each time this happens. Instead, I'll pick the one that makes the most sense. As always, all the sources I've used are on our website. Anyway, it seems likely that young Akhenaten co-ruled with his father for some years. As the heir apparent, the teenager would have needed to catch up quickly. We can only speculate about how he felt towards his father on a father-son level, but he certainly must have idolized him. In the fragments of friezes and statues from this period, if the teenager harbored any plans for his revolution by this point, he kept them to himself. Depictions and portraits followed the royal line, fairly normal depictions of the young prince showing him praising Amun. The first event that Akhenaten formally resided over was his father's funeral. Like all good pharaohs, Amenhotep III had long prepared for his death, and the same splendor that accompanied him through life would guide his soul back to the Aten, where he would rule for eternity. Shoulder to shoulder with subjugated vassal kings and weeping foreign emissaries, Akhenaten watched a procession of high officials ceremoniously pulling, like sled dogs, the gilded, heavy coffin of his father towards his enormous mortuary temple in the Valley of the Kings. As the chants and incense faded, Akhenaten found himself as the sole ruler of the most powerful kingdom in the world. His father's reign had been the most splendid in a millennia, but Akhenaten had already planned to eclipse it. Something truly revolutionary was coming to Egypt.
We often hear about the individuals who took the oath of office to become the chief executive. But what about the other people who play a role in each administration, or the events that may not be as well known, but that contribute to the reshaping of the office of the American presidency? On the Presidencies of the United States, we explore each administration beyond just the person holding the highest elected office in order to better understand the history that brought us to the modern day presidency. I hope you'll join me on this journey through the annals of presidential history. Presidencies can be found anywhere fine podcasts can be found, and is a proud member of the Evergreen Podcast Network.
Hello, my name is Peter Zablocki, and I'm a historian, author, and college professor. I'm thrilled to invite you to check out Evergreen Network's History Shorts podcast. Every Tuesday and Thursday, join me on a journey through time, exploring the little-known and hidden gems of history. In each bite-sized episode, I'll dive into my original research to bring you intriguing historical curiosities you've probably never heard of, uncovering the fascinating stories that have shaped our world, from forgotten figures to overlooked events. And the best part? I've condensed all this historical goodness into manageable chunks, perfect for your on-the-go lifestyle. Whether you're commuting to work or squeezing in a quick break, History Shorts fits into the little time you probably think you don't have. Subscribe now and never miss an episode of the History Shorts podcast, available wherever you get your podcasts.
When my brother, Amenhotep III, went to his fate, it was reported. When I heard what was reported, nothing was allowed to be cooked in a pot. On that day, I myself wept and sat, wrote Tushratta, king of the Mitanni. He continues. On that day I took neither food nor water. I grieved, saying, let even me be dead, or let 10,000 be dead in my country, and in my brother's country 10,000 as well. But let my brother, whom I love and whom loves me, be alive as long as heaven and earth. This mournful account is another one of the Amarna letters showing the reaction of other kings learning about the death of Amenhotep III. From Tushratta's letter, we learn that this VIP club of kings were eager to welcome their new brother, Akhenaten, into the fold. Egypt's vassal kings were even more sycophantic. It's very easy to imagine the smug grin stretching across the face of the teen as he read the correspondence from the king of a small city in modern Lebanon. Another Amman letter records, quote, "I fall at the feet of the king, my lord, 7 and 7 times. I am the dirt beneath the sandals of the king, my lord. My lord is the sun who comes forth over all lands day by day." Very quickly, the arrogance of the teenage pharaoh emerged. Already considering himself above these petty kings, Akhenaten quickly made a poor impression on them, forcing their messages to stand out in the sun, something foreign kings found bizarre and insulting. One wrote to Akhenaten saying, quote, "Why should messengers be made to stay constantly out in the sun and so die in the sun? If staying out in the sun means profit for Pharaoh, then let the messenger stay out and let him die right there in the sun. But for Pharaoh himself, there must be a profit. In other words, kill my messages if you wish, but at least have a good reason for doing so." But the new pharaoh cared little for the braying of barbarian kings. To bask in the light of his father, the Aten, was a privilege, even if they didn't understand it. Akhenaten saw his father's rule as the pinnacle, so rather than supplant it, he aimed to be a continuation of it, but with one key difference. Within the sacred temple of Thebes, where his father's jubilee festival concluded, he built a new wing, not within the temple itself or even near it. Akhenaten's new wing was constructed to the east of the temple, meaning the morning rays would greet his structure first. Named Gempa'aten, meaning the Aten is found, this was a deliberate snub to the high priests of Amun, and within this hastily built structure were the first representations of how he wished to be seen. Though his father had toyed with new forms of representation, Akhenaten took it to the next level. The young pharaoh and his immediate family were deliberately portrayed as different from all others. The cartoon-like eyes of his father's likeness were distorted further. Stretching them even longer and adding a sloping brow, the pharaoh's face was lean and his cheekbones raised and elongated. The pursed, thin lips of previous kings were replaced with plump, extended lips that curved around into a sly smile. But it was the pharaoh's body that was the strangest. Where his father showed himself as lean and muscular, Akhenaten once again emphasized how different his body was from others. A long, snake-like neck, elongated skull, thin, wiry limbs and a punching belly, Akhenaten was breaking new ground. No other pharaoh had cast himself in such a way, and none ever would again. Equally as strange was the prominent role his wife, Nefertiti, played in royal imagery. Few other pharaohs pictured their consorts, and for that matter, their children alongside them, but from the offset, Akhenaten seems to have intended for his entire family to be the center of the new cult. From the fragments that survive, we see the royal family portrayed in a much more intimate manner. Nefertiti sits on his lap, twisting her head around to kiss the pharaoh. His children, always pictured naked with extremely long, bald heads, play at their feet as the life-giving rays of the Aten shine down on the blessed family. Perhaps, most shockingly, a tiny fragment seems to show Nefertiti and Akhenaten getting into bed together. A shocking, almost pornographic image of the monarch. One can only wonder if there was a plaque that went with this one also. The first question is why? Why did Akhenaten choose to take this path? For reasons that aren't clear to us, Akhenaten was not on good terms with the priesthood of Amun. Even his egomaniac father had kept the priests of his patron god close by, but the teen seems to have spurned them from the get-go. It could be that he felt genuinely, spiritually connected to the Aten and felt Amun was nothing but a relic of the past. But it seems more likely that he resented the power this priesthood had over his kingdom, and rejecting their god was the quickest way to neuter them. Patience was not an attribute bestowed on Akhenaten. Zealously, he began numerous building projects imitating his father. But the quality was lacking. The shimmering quartzite his father utilized had to be quarried in Nubia, and that would take too long. Instead, Akhenaten had court artisans create his likeness in sandstone, a softer, weaker stone that was cheaper and quicker to work with. By the time of his third year on the throne, he celebrated his own jubilee festival, one that took a profoundly different tone to his father's. Surviving inscriptions tell us that the festival was not to celebrate Akhenaten, but the Aten itself. The government line was that his father had not really died, Instead, his spirit had merged with the Aten, where he would rule for eternity. The Aten ruled the celestial kingdom, and hand in hand, Akhenaten ruled the earthly one. In the fourth year of his rule, Akhenaten formally changed his name. For simplicity, I've been calling him Akhenaten, but up until this moment, his birth name had been Amenhotep IV. Not anymore. Pharaohs had numerous names and titles throughout their life, but changing one's birth name was unprecedented. Amenhotep IV, a name which meant Amun is pleased, became Akhenaten, meaning effective for the Aten. Nefertiti too adopted a new moniker, Nefer-Neferaten, meaning beauteous are the beauties of the Aten. What were the citizens of his empire to think of these profound changes? Did the new pharaoh really expect them to turn their back on generations of traditions on a whim? For the commoners, the intrigues of the king were a world away from their daily life. Each pharaoh had their own patron god and they had theirs. As long as they paid their taxes, well, life went on. But Akhenaten wasn't content with the Aten being just another god. In the city of Thebes, temples to various gods blotted out the skyline. Long ago had the temple replaced the pyramid as the ultimate symbol of majesty, and the towering structures at Thebes devoted mostly to Amun blocked the rays of the Aten, figuratively and literally. If the population was to truly embrace the Aten as their one true god, it could never happen here. The taint of Amun was too strong. Akhenaten had clipped the wings of the Amun priesthood, but the sheer scale of their cult meant he could only do so much. What he needed was a clean slate, a break from the past, virgin ground where his new religion could be nurtured. And so the search began for a new capital city, founded in honor of and eternally dedicated to the Aten. In his fifth year of rule, Akhenaten and his entourage assembled on a dry patch of earth. Halfway down the Nile on the east bank, Pharaoh Akhenaten lay the foundation stone for his new city. Full of excitement, his mind raced. This was much more than a city to him. This was a new empire, a new religion, a new order. On paper, it was dedicated to the Aten, but really, it was about himself and his father. By now, he'd set up the foundations, however wobbly, of his new religion. A multitude of high priests had begun rituals of offering for the Aten. In the open-air temples, plates of meat and fruit were piled high to nourish the hungry sun as he made his daily journey across the horizon. Scribes had written lengthy prayers and blessings for and about the Aten, though many were ripped straight from existing dedications to Amun. The people filling all these roles were new men, bureaucrats raised up from some obscure posting who now owed their careers to Akhenaten, and should they wish to maintain their cushy lifestyle, had a vested interest in the success of this new religion. The spot chosen for the capital was strategically placed in the middle of the two ancient capitals, Memphis and Thebes. Like everything Akhenaten did, this placement was symbolic. Here he could start afresh. It was an area free from the gods of old Memphis or new Thebes. As the warm fingers of the Aten crept slowly over the mountains, bathing the pharaoh in light, he declared triumphantly that in this location would be the new capital of his eternal religion. A place where false gods were banished and where the Aten would reign forever and ever. He christened it Akhetaten, meaning the horizon of the Aten. Rapidly, the city began to take shape with Akhenaten's vision, meticulously guiding the placement of each brick. In Egyptian mythology, there is life and there is the afterlife. As the sun rises in the east and sets in the west, the traditional burial sites for Egyptian pharaohs was on the west bank of the Nile, in the Valley of the Kings. There, in the dusky twilight under the watchful eye of Osiris, god of the underworld, a deceased pharaoh would navigate the perils of Judgment Day and hopefully arrive at the Field of Reeds, paradise. But Akhenaten changed this too. One of the first buildings he created was his royal tomb. Sitting on the east bank of the Nile, he decreed that wherever he died, it was here he was to be buried. Soon, an elaborate, though rushed, tomb was completed. It was enormous, far too big for one man, and that was because Akhenaten was building for the future. This site would be the new Valley of the Kings, where the body of all his heirs would remain after their souls made their final journey to join the Aten. In that vein, an equally large open-top temple to the Aten was constructed. Every one of these buildings was strategically placed so that when the Artan's golden fingers clawed over the mountain range each morning, they first illuminated the Pharaoh's administration, further proof that he was indeed beloved by the Artan. Deliberately contrasting the dark, incense-filled temples of Amun, these new temples had an open roofing. After all, this was a city for the Artan. The solar rays that he sent down were a gift and one that should not be squandered. All these changes probably left the public a little bewildered, not to mention foreign diplomats who were left scratching their heads trying to figure out what this Artan expected of them. But just like his father, Akhenaten cared not a bit for the opinions of foreign kings, too ignorant or barbaric to understand his religion. Both Akhenaten and his father had known nothing but prosperity and stability. They had squandered the lessons of their ancestors who had reconquered Egypt by the skin of their teeth. Bathed in the warmth of the Artan, the pharaoh was hell-bent on unraveling everything his ancestors had built. This, he knew, was the will of the Artan, and the Artan must be obeyed. Well guys, that is where we leave things for today. We'll be back in 2 weeks to finish this story. If you've enjoyed this episode, please don't forget to give us a 5-star rating on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. It really does help. Also, please consider joining our show's patrons. For just a few bucks a month, you can enjoy ad-free and early release episodes, as well as the personal satisfaction that comes from keeping an independent podcast free and easy to listen to. To all of the show's patrons, thanks so much for sticking with me through the break. And finally, a quick shout out to our Justinian tier members, Seth, Tom, Sam, Claudia, Angus, and John. Cheers, guys. See you on the next one.
I'm Ken Harbaugh, host of Warriors in Their Own Words, a podcast that presents the unvarnished, unsanitized truth of what we have asked of those who defend this nation. As a country, we need these stories more than ever. Stories from Americans who have borne the battle, including 30-year-old remastered interviews with veterans from World War I recounting their time in the trenches of Europe, and with veterans from World War II, Korea, Vietnam, and from our most recent conflicts in Iraq, Afghanistan, and other battlefields Americans may never have heard of. Hear their stories by listening to Warriors in Their Own Words wherever you find podcasts.
Hey, podcast listeners, I'm Paul Brandis introducing my podcast, Countdown to Dallas. It's a fascinating, in-depth look at the seemingly unconnected events that led to the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. It's based on my book of the same title. In that book and in this podcast, I go all the way back to 1939 when Lee Harvey Oswald was born into a troubled and dysfunctional family. I'll follow his transient and often violent teenage years and young adulthood, painting a fuller picture of the man who would later become Kennedy's killer. I also take a look at events unfolding in that era like Cuba and Vietnam, and I'll unpack the conspiracy theories too, not one of which has ever been conclusively proven. Subscribe to Countdown to Dallas at evergreenpodcasts.com or your favorite listening app, October 31st.